Welcome to Catholic Answers Live, the program where you participate with your questions about apologetics and evangelization, including the most important theological, spiritual, moral, and social issues facing the world today. We're not taking live calls. However, we invite you to stay with us and enjoy the broadcast. Now, from San Diego, Catholic Answers Live.
Thank you for joining us on Catholic Answers Live this Good Friday. Second hour, a Good Friday reflection on the Passion of the Lord with Father Vincent Serpa. I highly recommend you hang around for that. And if you are not able to, that you find it on YouTube or Facebook or Catholic.com treat yourself to that reflection from Father Vincent Serpa. This hour, we talk about the last days of Jesus our Lord, and joining us is Jimmy Akin, senior apologist here at Catholic Answers. Hi, Jimmy.
Howdy, Si. How you doing?
Very well. Happy Good Friday to you.
Likewise.
And you have a lot of details in that head of yours, and I want to get them out today. As far, well,
this
I'm not surgically.
Surgery.
I could see the look on your face. No, about the last days that the Lord. In some cases, endured here on earth, maybe.
Sure.
And then what the meaning of all that is, and I'm sure much of the meaning comes out just by reflecting on the events. And we're already past a good deal of Holy Week, but I want to begin, if we could, with the triumphant entry of Jesus, because that really begins the whole thing.
Right. That's the beginning. It's in all four Gospels, and it's kind of the event that kicks off the final phase of our Lord's ministry.
Right. And how are we to take this, that he's being welcomed as an earthly kind of Messiah? Is that there's a certain expectation around him?
Yeah. Now, so for people who may not be familiar with it, at the triumphal entry, a week before the crucifixion, Jesus rode into Jerusalem, and he rode in on an ass, which is significant in itself because asses were ridden in peacetime. They were beasts of burden. You've heard of probably of war horses, but you've never heard of war asses,
right?
And so it was an animal of peace, and he's modeling this event off one that happened in the Old Testament, where at Solomon's coronation, Solomon did the same thing. Solomon also, his name as a king, his name means peace. And so this is the image of a peaceful king coming to Jerusalem, not a conquering king. And it was also prophesied in the book of Zechariah that the Messiah would do this. And so Jesus is fulfilling that, and that's the basic reason why he's doing the triumphal entry. He's publicly embracing his role as Messiah. A lot of people at the time, you know, they recognized him as a prophet, and this also laid claim to the messiahship. He's presenting himself as the King of Israel. Mm-hmm. But many of the people didn't understand the non-conquering aspect of this. They expected him to be a political deliverer who would lead a rebellion and kick out the Romans. And so this would have been a very alarming thing for the Jewish authorities, and it's one of the things that kind of advanced on their agenda the idea that we need to get rid of this guy, because otherwise he's going to start a war. Mm-hmm. At least that's how they perceived it.
So there must have been a significant number of people there for them to perceive it as much of a threat. Had it been like two or three people, it wouldn't – well, I will forget about that guy.
Right. This was something that was a large-scale event. Now, there were people who were coming with Jesus as he did this. Mm-hmm. But then they encounter the city. And in one of the Gospels, it says, you know, the whole city was wondering what's up with this. And they were asking, who is this? And the people who were accompanying him said, this is the prophet Jesus from Nazareth in Galilee. And so you have these two groups of people, the people who were following Jesus and the city that was alarmed by his arrival. And this is significant because sometimes you'll hear preachers say things like, oh, the same crowd that was acclaiming him as the Messiah just days later was shouting, give us Barabbas and crucify him.
Yeah.
No, we have two different crowds. The ones that accompanied him, that recognized him as the Messiah, they're not the ones shouting, give us Barabbas. It's the people who didn't know him, who lived in the city that were doing that, who were stirred up by the temple authorities. And so when you hear that preached, it doesn't actually correspond to the dynamic we have going on in the Gospels. Jesus's followers were not so fickle as to be proclaiming him the Messiah and a week later demanding that he be crucified.
Okay. And the thing about that ass that he rode in on, however, he has actually given instructions about – he sends two people off to get that animal, and the animal's never been ridden before. Or something. Mm-hmm. So tell me, what about that?
That goes along with the prophecy in Zechariah.
Okay.
And so that's why he's doing that. But there's something really interesting that happens, and it kind of sets us up for something that recurs later in the gospel accounts, which is we have Jesus send disciples on missions to do things that – you could look at it and say, okay, is this a prophecy?
Yeah.
Or is it something –
like, how did he know that –
is it something else? I mean, now obviously he's a prophet, so he knows these things. I mean, he's the Son of God. He's divine. He has all knowledge. But it also looks like this was kind of a prearranged thing because Jesus is envisioning – he says as they're coming, you know, alongside the east side of Jerusalem, they're by the Mount of Olives. They come by this village. Jesus says, go into the village and you're going to find a colt that's never been ridden tied up out in front of somebody's house. And if anybody asks you what are you doing when you untie it, well, tell them the Lord needs it and he'll send it right back. So that sounds like the people in the house already know about this. Mm-hmm. They've already tied this animal out front, which why would you do that with a colt that's never been ridden? Why would you just tie it out in front of your house? And they already know who the Lord is, and they are already kind of expecting this. And so it looks like this is some kind of prearranged thing. But we're not told the identities of these people, and it's done in a kind of way that gives the people deniability.
Oh.
Because they've left this animal out in front, and someone picks it up and does something with it and just happens to be in something that could be interpreted as a revolutionary act,
right,
you know,
and
then they bring it back. And so it looks like these people have a kind of deniability to protect them. And that's actually a theme that we can talk about as we go a little bit further because it keeps cropping up in the Gospels.
Can you give us a physical sense of where this begins and ends, this whole triumphal entry?
Yeah. So the Mount of Olives is on the east side of Jerusalem. It's across Jerusalem from it's across the Kidron Valley from Jerusalem. It's not a very big valley. You can walk across it in a few minutes. And there were little villages located at different points on the Mount of Olives, including Bethany, which is a very famous one. Mary, Martha, and Lazarus lived there. Mm-hmm. And so this procession would have started on the east side of Jerusalem where they picked up the ass and then presumably gone into Jerusalem on the eastern side, which is also something that there was a kind of messianic expectation. There's an eastern gate on the eastern side of Jerusalem that's kind of thought to be reserved for the Messiah. It's also the direction of the rising sun. And so you have this kind of eastward to westward imagery mm-hmm. that's happening here, emphasizing Jesus' role as Messiah.
Well, we got to take a break. Jimmy Akin is our guest this hour as we discuss the last days of Jesus on this earth. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. We'll be right back with more on Catholic Answers Live.
Catholic Answers Live.
We hear it every year. The perennial question: what are you giving up for Lent? And there's nothing wrong with doing without certain things you may have an affinity for. But this year, why not turn the question around and ask, what are you taking on for Lent? Did you know that by investing as little as 5 minutes a day, you can take on a Lenten practice that will both build up and inform your faith? A Daily Defense is the perfect book for your Lenten journey. Jimmy Akin takes up a different challenge for every day of the year, teaching you how you can defend the faith and give answers to Catholics and skeptics alike. And it's user-friendly, so finding the answers can be quick and easy. Make this Lent one to remember. Order your copy of A Daily Defense today by calling 1-888-291-8000, visiting Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Homeschool Connections, an online provider of courses for your Catholic homeschool, is a sponsor of Catholic Answers Live. Homeschool Connections website is homeschoolconnections.com.
Catholic Answers Live is brought to you in part by CatholicSingles.com, the website for Catholics who want to meet others who share their Catholic values for faith, fellowship, and love. You can learn more at CatholicSingles.com. Catholic Answers Live thanks CatholicSingles.com for their generous support.
Good Friday on the Catholic Answers Minute. It has been over 2,000 years since that first Good Friday, which is unlike any day that preceded it or has followed it. It is the day in which God revealed the most he has ever revealed about himself. At the Last Supper, Jesus said, "As the Father has loved me, so I love you." But on Good Friday, he showed us what he meant. The disciples were frightened. Since he would not let them fight, they fled. Only John and the women stood at the foot of the cross. John's was the unique and unspeakable honor of giving comfort to Mary, the mother of Jesus, and therefore to Jesus as well. As we reflect on the infinite generosity of this day, let us resolve not to let a further day go by that we don't give thanks for it.
We're not taking live calls. However, we invite you to stay with us and enjoy the broadcast. This is Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to a special broadcast for Good Friday here on Catholic Answers. Our guest Jimmy Akin is walking us through or helping us to understand the significance or doing both of those things of the last days of Jesus on this earth. Jesus makes his triumphal entry then into Jerusalem. And then one of the very significant things that happens at some time during that week is the cleansing of the temple.
Yes.
So, well, first of all, when does that happen, do you think?
It's a little unclear because it is placed differently by Matthew and Mark. So in Mark, what happens is Jesus comes into Jerusalem, he goes to the temple, he looks around, and then he goes to Bethany for the night. And then he comes back the next day, he sees the fig tree, curses it, goes to the temple, cleanses it, and then they go back and see the fig tree is withered. In Matthew, the sequence is a bit different. Jesus comes in, immediately cleanses the temple, then they go to Jerusalem, then the next day he both curses the fig tree and they see it withered. So it's a little unclear what the historical sequencing was. The evangelists have the freedom to arrange their material topically rather than chronologically.
Yeah.
And it's a little unclear in this case which principles are being applied by which evangelist. You could look at Matthew and say, well, okay, so Matthew has put the two things about the fig tree together. So he's arranging them topically. But you could also look at Mark because there's a known phenomenon in Mark where Mark will interrupt one story with another story and then go back to the first one. So he like sandwiches one story between parts of two others. And scholars actually call these Markan sandwiches. And it looks like we have a Markan sandwich involving the fig tree in the temple because you first have the cursing of the fig tree, then you have the cleansing of the temple, then you have the withering of the fig tree. And so that has been taken as one of the paradigm cases of a Markan sandwich because what happens in these is the kind of framing story sheds light on the central story.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you have the fig tree, you know, Jesus goes to it and it's not the time for figs yet, we're told, but it's already got leaves. Well, so what modern people tend not to know is that fig trees had a reputation for putting out fruit before they put out their leaves.
Oh.
And so if this tree, even though it's early and it's already got leaves, you would expect it to have fruit. But so it's like the tree is making a big ostentatious show with its leaves, but then it has no fruit. And so Jesus uses this as an occasion to do a kind of spiritual object lesson because the Jewish authorities similarly make a big show of spirituality but actually lack spiritual fruit. And just like the temple, which is kind of the center of all of that, is going to be destroyed – And it's become corrupt as a result of this kind of false religiosity, and that's going to bring judgment on the temple in the same way Jesus brings judgment on the fig tree to signify the same thing, that if you're going to make a religious show, you better have the fruit to back it up. And so it seems like the fig tree is kind of an enacted parable about the Jerusalem authorities and the temple.
And so why is Jesus upset in the temple itself? Why does he do what he does?
Well, he's upset at the corruption that's involved there. And in fact, he's not the first one, because there are precedents in the Old Testament prophets for condemning the selling of things in the temple. Also, Jesus mentions in particular a line from the prophets about my house will be a house of prayer for the Gentiles. And this is something we often don't think about because it's the Jewish temple, right? So we assume only Jews go there. But that's not the case. The way the temple was structured, there was a series of concentric courts, and the outer court was devoted for the Gentiles. So people who were not Jews could come there and worship God and pray and have sacrifices taken in by the priests to be offered for them. Then within that, there was what was known as the court of women, where women could go. Then there was the court of Israel, where men could go. And then within that, there was the priestly court. Mm-hmm. And then within that, there was the Holy of Holies, where only the high priest could go only once a year. So you have this kind of concentric set of zones, and the outermost zone is specifically reserved for the Gentiles and for their worship of God. That's where it seems the merchants had set up shop. And so they were using this space that was designated for Gentiles to come and worship God to just make money. And so even though there's nothing wrong with changing people's money, there's nothing wrong with selling sacrificial animals to them, you're not supposed to be doing it here because this space has been set aside for worship. And so that's part of what was driving Jesus's concern here. And in fact, we know about Gentiles who did worship God at the temple. Either they went there themselves or they would have sacrifices offered for them, including Roman emperors.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So why then – in the Synoptic Gospels, all this happens in Holy Week, mm-hmm. but in John's Gospel, not.
It's right. So in John's Gospel, the cleansing of the temple is presented in John chapter 2. It's right at the beginning of his Gospel. And there's been a question about that. Some people have suggested that, okay, John is an eyewitness. He's giving us the actual chronology. Mm-hmm. And so Jesus really did this at the beginning of his ministry, and the other evangelists placed it later to bring out the connection mm-hmm. with Jesus' own crucifixion. That's possible. My own personal preference is to say Jesus did this twice, that he did it both at the beginning and the end of his ministry. And so, you know, what would have happened after the first time is exactly what you would expect. They just set up shop again afterwards and continued doing it. And then he came back at the end of his ministry and he did it again. And so I think what John is actually doing, because he's writing to supplement the other Gospels, I think he's telling us this happened a second time.
I see. I see. And now, although the week then is full of conflict between mm-hmm. Jesus and others.
Yeah.
So they challenge his authority.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the first thing that happens is the temple authorities come to him and say, well, who gave you the authority to do this? Because they're the ones who are in charge.
Yeah.
And so it's like, who are you to be doing this? And Jesus poses a counter question. He says, well, I'll tell you if you tell me who authorized the ministry of John the Baptist. And that puts them in a dilemma because – now what he's implying is it's the same source.
Same
source. So it's God.
Yeah, right.
God gave me the authority to do this. But he's not outright saying that, so they can't, you know, try to get him on that basis. So what he does is he stymies them because they realize the people think – John is a prophet, and they might even stone us if we say, well, John's baptism was of men.
Uh-huh.
But we don't want to acknowledge that John's baptism is of God, because then that's going to give Jesus standing. Mm-hmm. And so they say, we don't know. And Jesus says, well, then I'm not going to tell you. So that's how kind of the first conflict goes. But then it progresses, and you have different groups coming to Jesus and kind of testing him. One of the more famous examples of this is when you have a group of Pharisees and Herodians come to Jesus. Now, Pharisees were kind of popular Jewish religious leaders. They didn't like the Romans, whereas the Herodians were people who were associated with King Herod, who was a Roman client king. He was a puppet ruler for the Romans. And so these guys are like Roman collaborators.
Mm-hmm.
So you have the Pharisees who aren't on the side of Rome and the Roman collaborators coming to Jesus, and they pose him this question, is it lawful to pay taxes to Caesar or not? And this is their attempt to turn the tables on Jesus, just like he had just put them in a dilemma. Now they're trying to do that to him. And so if he says, well, no, you shouldn't pay taxes to Caesar, the Herodians are going to go report that to Herod, and that gives them standing to take action against Jesus.
Right.
On the other hand, if he says you should pay taxes to Caesar, then that's going to displease the Pharisees and all the people who go along with the Pharisees because they were popular religious leaders, and that will cost Jesus standing with the popular folk. So so what he does in reply is he splits the difference. And he says, bring me a coin. He says specifically it's a denarius, which is a kind of is sort of a small coin. It was a day's wages for a laborer at the time. And since this was during the reign of the emperor Tiberius, that's the Caesar whose image would have been on the coin. It would have been Tiberius's image. I actually I have a few coins myself that I've collected, and I have one of these Tiberius denarii, which is pretty cool.
Wow.
But anyway, so he says, bring me a coin whose image is on it. And they say Caesar's. So it's Tiberius Caesar. He says, well, give to Caesar what is Caesar's and give to God what is God's. And so he splits the difference, indicating some things are legitimately Caesar's, some things are legitimately God's. Don't confuse them. And he thus neutralizes the attempt to put him in a dilemma.
He's really showing a cleverness.
He's very thoughtful about all this.
Right, right. Yeah. And so, you mentioned the Pharisees and the Herodians. What about the Sadducees?
The Sadducees also come, and they kind of pose a theological test. They have this now. Sadducees didn't believe there was going to be a resurrection of the dead. They thought that God exists, but they didn't believe in angels or souls or spirits or the resurrection. So they thought when you die, you're worm food. And they come to Jesus with a kind of theological puzzle, which they've come up with as an argument against the resurrection. They say, okay, suppose there's a guy who marries a woman and dies before he is able to have any children with her. According to the law of Moses, what's supposed to happen is one of his brothers is supposed to marry her and then raise up children for the dead brother. This is a custom known as the Levirate marriage. Levir is a Latin word. It means brother-in-law. So the woman's supposed to marry her brother-in-law to get a child as an heir for her original dead husband. But the Sadducees take this a few steps further. They say, suppose the second brother dies too, and suppose she keeps running through brothers until she's been married to seven different brothers. All of them have died without giving her children. Finally, she dies. So since she's been married to all of them, whose wife is she going to be when the resurrection happens? Answer that, Mr.
Smart
Resurrection Believer.
Yeah, okay,
yeah,
right.
And Jesus does something very interesting here. He says, you know neither the scripture nor the power of God. And specifically, he cites a passage in the Pentateuch, in the law of Moses. And there's a reason he does that. Now, you might think, why doesn't he just go to Daniel, where it's real clear in Daniel 12 there's going to be a resurrection of the dead.
Mm-hmm.
You know, many are who sleep in the dust are going to awake, some to everlasting glory, some to everlasting shame. Real clear testimony to the resurrection there in Daniel and in other places. Well, the thing is the Sadducees didn't accept that book as scripture. According to various early Christian sources, the only books that the Sadducees accepted were the five books of Moses. And so Jesus quotes from one of those to give them an answer, and we can talk about that on the other side of the break.
Nice tease, Jimmy Akin. Thank you for joining us for this special edition of Catholic Answers Live for Good Friday. More on Holy Week and Jesus' last days on the earth. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. As I said, Jimmy Akin is our guest, and we'll be right back with more on Catholic Answers Live.
We're here for you. Call now. Catholic Answers Live.
The essence of Christianity is this. We hold fast to what we were given by those who came before us. Throughout history, God's saving revelation has been proclaimed, preserved, and passed on, each generation staying true to the teaching it received. In his new book, Handed Down, The Catholic Faith of the Early Christians, author James L. Papandrea offers a fascinating window into the life of the early church, a time in which the church fathers took the gospel they received and developed the doctrines and practices that define the faith that we profess today. Handed Down is perfect for history-conscious Protestants looking for a friendly defense of Catholic belief, as well as for Catholics who want to deepen their connection with our forefathers in the faith. Order your copy of Handed Down today by calling 1-888-291-8000, going to Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
We hear it every year. The perennial question, what are you giving up for Lent? And there's nothing wrong with doing without certain things you may have an affinity for. But this year, why not turn the question around and ask, what are you taking on for Lent? Have you considered helping a friend or family member as they journey into the Catholic Church? It's called Friendship Evangelization. And so you don't have to go it alone. Author Devin Rose has written Navigating the Tiber, How to Help Your Friends and Family Journey Toward the Catholic Faith. Not only does he equip you with the knowledge from Scripture, the early church, and Christian history, he shows you how to deal with the common aspects of a convert's journey. Make this Lent one to remember. Order your copy of Navigating the Tiber today by calling 1-888-291-8000, visiting Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live, this special edition for Good Friday. Jimmy Akin is our guest, and when we left, you left us with a little bit of a cliffhanger.
Yeah. So Jesus is talking to the Sadducees, who only accept the five books of Moses, but they want a proof of the resurrection. And so Jesus gives them one using just texts from there, and he says, well, okay, God is referred to as the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. But he's also referred to as not the God of the dead, but of the living. Therefore, there must be some sense in which Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob are still living, even though they're dead. Therefore, souls exist. Therefore, the resurrection happens. And it's, you know, to us, it's obvious. This isn't the clearest statement of the resurrection one could have, like we find in Daniel.
Right.
But that's the reason he's doing this, is because he's quoting from what they will consider authoritative. And that's something, as an apologist, I do all the time. You know, if I'm dealing with Protestants, and let's say, who don't accept all the books of the Catholic canon of Scripture, then I'll quote the books they do accept to try to support Catholic teachings. And so it's neat for me as an apologist to see Jesus doing the same thing there.
And then the widow.
So the widow's mite.
Yes.
Right. Yeah. So there's an interesting thing that that whenever you hear the widow's mite preached, it's always in terms of what an amazing good thing she did. You know, she gave these two coins. It was all she had. Not quite sure if that's literal or not, but in any event, she's very impoverished and she's giving out of her poverty. And so she's engaging in this form of sacrificial giving, and that's praiseworthy to her compared to these other people who are giving objectively much larger amounts, but money they can spare. And if you stop there, now that's all true. But if you stop there, you may miss something else, because if you look in Mark, he has just – this is like within the two verses just before this. Jesus has been condemning the Pharisees and the religious authorities specifically for devouring widows' houses, taking all of their money. Now, obviously, they didn't barge in and take it. But what they did do is they encouraged a form of spirituality that would take money from people that they actually needed. And then he sees a woman come and do exactly this. So whereas it may be heroically virtuous for the woman to do this, believing that she needed to.
Mm-hmm.
There's also, it seems, an implicit criticism of the Pharisees and the religious authorities for preaching a spirituality that would drive an impoverished woman to do this. And that's something that we can miss if we don't read the text in its context.
It gives us a sense of his
compassion.
And also that he honored her for following the religious authorities, even as he said the religious authorities were wrong.
Right.
To do that.
And it also fits with a recurring theme of Jesus having a more compassionate application of the law than the authorities do.
And then the Olivet Discourse. What's that about?
Well, so we mentioned the Mount of Olives, which is across from Jerusalem. Mm-hmm. And Jesus would go back to Bethany every night. He'd leave the temple area. And so as he's leaving it one day, the disciples are commenting to him about how gorgeous the temple is. And this is something we know from history. Herod's temple was amazing. It was covered in like white limestone and gold, and it was just gorgeous. It was considered by some the eighth wonder of the ancient world. And there was a saying among the rabbis that if you hadn't seen the temple, you had not seen a beautiful building. And so it's very natural for the disciples to be commenting on this as they're leaving the temple for the evening. And as they're doing that, though, Jesus says, you see these stones? Every one of them is going to be torn down. And so as they're making their way across the Mount of Olives, they say, okay, can you tell us about that? and so he does, and he gives this discourse, prophetic discourse, known as the Olivet Discourse, because it's given on the Mount of Olives. And basically, when people read this, they tend to want to associate this with our future, with the second coming.
Yeah.
And there may be some of that in there, but really, if you look at the way it's set up, what they're asking about is the destruction of the temple.
Mm-hmm.
And so that should be our primary line of interpretation for what this is all about. And he then goes on to say there are going to be wars and rumors of wars, and there's going to be earthquakes, and there's going to be false messiahs, and all of this is going to lead up, in essence, to the destruction of the temple. And he gives a description. It includes some poetic elements and some symbolic elements, but it basically fits the time period leading up to the Jewish war that started in the AD 60s and that climaxed with the destruction of the temple in AD 70. And so he said all of this is going to happen in this generation, and he's talking probably in AD 33, and by AD 70, 37 years later, it had all happened.
You're saying maybe in a symbolic way it refers to the end times or something like that, but concretely he's actually telling them about the temple.
That's what they're asking about. It's what he's talking about. There may be some elements about the second coming mixed in there, and we know sometimes prophecies get fulfilled at more than one time in history in more than one way. So I'm not denying that there's a connection with the second coming here, but what they're asking about is the destruction of the temple.
And then he is anointed. And who anoints him, and why is he anointed?
Well, his interpretation of it that he articulates is it's for his burial. But it's not clear that that would have been understood by the disciples, because they're not at this point believing he's even going to die, even though he's said it multiple times.
Right.
It's also not clear it would have been understood by the woman who anointed him.
Mm-hmm.
What she probably understood it to mean is he's the Messiah. Messiah means anointed one. He's just publicly announced his messiahship by the triumphal entry and by the clearing of the temple. And so now it's time for him to be anointed. And so she fulfills that aspect of his role as the Messiah by anointing him with very expensive oil, which is what you'd want to use for
the Messiah.
Messianic coronation.
Yeah.
And so that's presumably what her motive is. You ask who she is. Actually, we're not told in the Synoptic Gospels, but we are told in John, and it's Mary of Bethany. It's Lazarus's sister. And scholars have said, well, why do we have her identity revealed here in John when it wasn't revealed in the Synoptic Gospels? Because she is mentioned in the Synoptic. She's mentioned in Luke. So why? And a prominent speculation on this that I think has a lot of merit is it's for protective anonymity. Because if you're the person who anoints a messianic claimant as the Messiah, you're participating in a revolutionary act.
Yeah.
And
just like the people with the
ass. Like the people with the ass. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so the theory is that the synoptic evangelists don't reveal her identity, even though it would have been known to all the Christians in Jerusalem. But then when John writes his gospel, for whatever reason, Mary of Bethany is no longer in danger. Either she's moved or she's passed on or something. Mm-hmm. And so she's no longer in danger from the Jerusalem authorities, and so her name can safely be revealed.
Might she have left Jerusalem? Because Christians did leave Jerusalem before.
There was a persecution that drove them out, so it's quite possible.
Which brings us then, if I could jump to it, to the Last Supper.
Yeah.
And so how does Jesus end up there?
Well, so this is another one of these intriguing things. Just like he sent two disciples to find the ass, he sends two disciples to find the house where they're going to have the Last Supper. And he says, so go into the city and you're going to see a man carrying a water jug on his head, which is not normal because fetching water was considered women's work. So this is going to be a conspicuous sign. They're going to see this guy. Follow him to this house. Tell the householder that Jesus wants to have Passover supper here, and he'll show you an upper room that's already ready.
Mm-hmm.
So again, this is another thing you look at it. It could be divine foreknowledge, but it also looks like this is something Jesus has prearranged.
Yeah.
And so we're actually not told who this householder is. And even though the Christians in Jerusalem would have known this, I mean, they would have remembered this for years, we're not told who it is. And it seems like it might also be protective anonymity functioning here. There's also a question of why didn't Jesus just tell the disciples where to go? You know, just go to so-and-so's house. Why didn't they do that? Why have the rigmarole with the guy with the water jug? Well, one of the things that's been suggested for this is that it kept knowledge of where they're going to eat from even the 12 to the last second, so that it wasn't known in advance even by the 12. Can you think of anybody in the 12 who might have liked to know where this was going to happen early?
Right. So if they're talking about this, then Judas Iscariot would
have known and would have been able to get the authorities word of where Jesus was going to be, because we're told he's already looking for an opportunity to betray Jesus to them.
Right.
And so Jesus doesn't want to be taken before he has the chance to eat the Passover meal.
Yeah.
And so he doesn't let them know where they're going to eat the Passover meal until very late in the game. And that forces Judas into the position of going to the Passover meal, learning where they're going to go next to the Garden of Gethsemane.
Right.
And that's when he splits to tell the Jerusalem authorities where they can arrest Jesus.
So Jesus gave himself time to celebrate the Last Supper.
Exactly.
One of the most important things in the history of the world.
Yeah.
He needed a few hours
to
get that done. More on the last day. Well, now we're into the last hours of the life of the Lord on earth with Jimmy Akin when we come back.
You're listening to Catholic Answers Live.
It may be true for you, but not for me. How often have you heard this during a discussion with friends or family? Whether talking about faith, morality, politics, or just the basic notion of truth, so many people are captive to the notion of relativism, the belief that reality is something we decide. In his new audio presentation, Your Truth, My Truth, apologist Carlo Broussard breaks down this intellectual cancer, looking at the different kinds of relativism we regularly encounter and demonstrating how, ultimately, they collapse under the weight of their own incoherence. More importantly, Carlo makes a powerful case for the existence of objective truth, showing you how to explain to others that right and wrong are both real and universal, because it was designed that way by God. Order your copy of Your Truth, My Truth by calling 1-888-291-8000, logging on to the shop at catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
St. Paul's street evangelization isn't like other evangelism you might have seen on the streets. We don't yell, and we don't force anyone to pay attention to us. Instead, St. Paul's street evangelization is committed to presenting a positive, passionately Catholic presence to a world hungry for truth. For more information or to start a chapter of your own, go to www.streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com. It's time to do our part.
We hear it every year. The perennial question, what are you giving up for Lent? And there's nothing wrong with doing without certain things you may have an affinity for. But this year, why not turn the question around and ask, what are you taking on for Lent? Did you know that by investing as little as 5 minutes a day, you can take on a Lenten practice that will both build up and inform your faith? A Daily Defense is the perfect book for your Lenten journey. Jimmy Akin takes up a different challenge for every day of the year, teaching you how you can defend the faith and give answers to Catholics and skeptics alike. And it's user-friendly, so finding the answers can be quick and easy. Make this Lent one to remember. Order your copy of A Daily Defense today by calling 1-888-291-8000, visiting Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
We're not taking live calls. However, we invite you to stay with us and enjoy the broadcast. This is Catholic Answers Live.
Thank you again for being with us this Good Friday edition of Catholic Answers Live. We are working our way through the last week in Jesus' earthly ministry, but now we are into the final hours. And so let's move then from the Last Supper mm-hmm. to the Garden of Gethsemane. Where's mm-hmm. that?
It's on the Mount of Olives. And
so back to the Mount of Olives now.
Jesus keeps going back and forth between right. there and between Jerusalem and Bethany. And so it's not a real big place. You can go there today, or at least where we think it was. And they have lots of olive trees there still today, which is why it was called the Mount of Olives. And so in the Garden of Gethsemane, he prays. And a lot of people have said, well, how do we know what he prayed? Because he was kind of alone.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, he wasn't fully alone. He had the 12 with him, and he kind of deposited most of them in one area. And then he took Peter, James, and John and said, come with me a little further. And he had them camp out, and then he went a little further yet. But he's like a stone's throw away. He's not very far away. And so he's very moved in prayer. And even though they fell asleep, they wouldn't have fallen asleep instantly. And so they probably heard some of what he was praying. It's also possible he told them about it later, you know, during the 40 days between the resurrection and the ascension. But it's also very possible that, you know, they overheard enough of his prayer that he was probably, as was the custom then, praying out loud.
Mm-hmm.
And they would have heard it, at least the gist of what he was praying.
And then when the authorities come, one of the servants is struck on the ear.
Yes, right. So we're told in the synoptics that the synoptics are Matthew, Mark, and Luke. But not John.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're told in the synoptics that one of Jesus's followers took a sword and struck an ear off one of the servants of the high priest, which Jesus then heals and says, put your sword away, and he heals the guy. But we're not told who that is in the synoptics. But once again, we are told in John,
mm-hmm.
and it's Peter. And so, you know, Peter's the head disciple. All kinds of other things get attributed to him in the other Gospels. Why wouldn't this be attributed? And again, the thought is, well, okay, so for as long as Peter was living in Jerusalem, if it had been known that he was the one who in the darkness had done that to the high priest's servant who's still living there in Jerusalem, he would be subject to prosecution. And so this is more protective anonymity. It was to keep Peter from getting into further trouble, having a prosecutable charge lodged against him by the Jerusalem authorities.
And then the young man runs away naked. And I've always thought that seems so freighted with meaning, but I don't know what it means.
Yeah, it's really puzzling. And some people have thought – now, this is the most common suggestion you're going to hear, that's Mark. Because we know Mark was a young man who lived in Jerusalem. His mother had a house there. And so we meet him. It's actually like we meet him in Acts for the first time in Acts chapter 12, which is about a decade later.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a young man then, so he would have been really young in AD 33.
Yeah.
So it even though people have suggested this is Mark talking about himself, there's some reason to question that.
Okay.
But there are some other suggestions. It could just be someone we don't know. It could be another instance of protective anonymity. because there was someone else who the authorities were trying to kill at this time that we know about from John's gospel.
Oh.
Lazarus.
Yeah.
Because Jesus had just raised Lazarus from the dead. It had really upped Jesus' standing in popular opinion. It was making him more threatening to the Jerusalem authorities. And so they were plotting, John tells us, to kill Lazarus. And it's been suggested that this was Lazarus accompanying Jesus. And he may have even been wearing his grave clothes to display them and say, look at what Jesus did for me.
Right.
And so then when they grabbed him by the grave clothes, he had no choice but to literally
escape.
Yeah. That's where the word escape comes from, get out of your cape, and flee. And so we really don't know, but it's an intriguing suggestion.
Well, let me ask you, because there's not a lot of time left. And I want to get to quite a lot left.
Yeah.
But so Jesus has a trial. Is it a legal trial? I mean, what's going on here?
There's debates about that. People have pointed out various flaws in the legal proceedings that are held against Jesus. In particular, having a hearing before the Sanhedrin at night would not be regular, especially not at time of a festival. And so that's certainly a legal irregularity. Whether it would make it illegal is another question. To my mind, what does it matter if they observed the legal niceties or not? This was an objectively immoral thing they were doing.
Right.
But it looks like they may have been concerned with some of the legal formalities because they then appear to have had another meeting early in the morning before they take him to Pilate, and that they could say, okay, well, the preliminary hearing couldn't have counted as a trial, so we did a quick hearing in the morning just to observe the formalities before we bring him over to Pilate. And they needed to do that because, as we learn again in John's gospel, the Romans had deprived them of the ability to just use the death penalty.
Right.
And so they needed to get the Roman procurator's buy-in, and they needed something other than, well, he's a blasphemer, to justify his execution by the Roman authorities. So they try to portray him as this messianic claimant who's a rival king to the ones the Romans have instituted.
And next hour, Father Vincent Serpa will do a full reflection with us on Good Friday. So I think I may overpass some of that.
Yeah,
pass
absolutely.
A bit of that.
Are you making a pun?
I didn't mean to, but I did. I didn't, in fact, make a pun, but not intentionally. Would you mind if we move to the resurrection?
Sure, then? Sure.
And so 3 days. What happened here? It's 2 days, really. And when did he rise from the dead?
Okay. So, you know, we have these various expressions in the gospel that say he'll rise on the third day.
Yeah.
And a couple of times we have a statement that he'll be in the tomb 3 days and three nights, which is another way of saying on the third day. It can't literally mean 72 hours because if it meant 72 hours, then think about the implications of that. We know that he rose at nighttime. Okay, so you know, between sundown on Saturday and sunrise on Sunday, that's when he rose. So it was at night. Well, if you back up 72 hours from night, you're still in night.
Yeah.
And so that means he would have had to have been crucified and died at night. And we know that's not the case because he was crucified in the day and he died in the afternoon. So it can't be a literal full 3 days and three nights.
Yeah.
What sheds light on it is a knowledge of how the ancients reckoned time and anything for that matter. They would frequently count parts as wholes. So if you have part of one day, that's a day. If you have another day, that's a second day. And if you have part of a third day, that's the third day. So he was crucified and died on a Friday afternoon. Then you have all of Saturday starting at sundown and ending at sundown on Saturday. And then you have his resurrection on what they would have counted as Sunday, which is between Saturday evening and Sunday morning. So that's the 3 days. It's the one full day and parts of two others.
And it's clear that it did mean that, because if it didn't mean that, they would have just changed. I mean, like if they were trying to fool you with something.
Exactly.
So it's obvious that in their time this was completely non-controversial because
They say it repeatedly, and it's clearly how it would have been understood at the time.
And how do we reconcile the details of the different angels at the tomb?
Well, so evangelists had to choose which details they were going to include. One thing, and I've mentioned this on other occasions, but books back then were fantastically expensive, and so there was always price pressure to make them affordable by keeping them short. And so the disciples had lots of information about Jesus. They couldn't possibly include it all. And so they had to make choices about details. Some of them choose to mention more detail than others. All of them mention an angelic presence at the tomb. All four Gospels do that. In some cases, like in want to say Mark and Luke, it's two angels, but in Matthew, it's only one. But that's simply up to the choices of the individuals. The more notable detail that's different with the angels is Matthew's angel comes down from heaven and rolls away the stone and sits on it before talking to the women. And that may be Matthew's way of showing who it is that rolled away the stone. Because in the other Gospels, they show up and the stone's already rolled away.
Right.
And they're even wondering who's going to roll it away for us. And so the implication is that it was done supernaturally, that an angel rolled away the stone. But the other Gospels don't show that. And so Matthew makes it explicit to make it clear to the reader how the stone was rolled away. And he does that in accord with the standard way that the evangelist will have sometimes of either mentioning or not mentioning the agency through which something is accomplished.
And a similar thing about the different accounts of women at the
Yes.
tomb?
Yeah. So from Luke, we know that there were at least six women who showed up, maybe more than that. And if each one of the Gospels listed all of them, it would have been just too chaotic. And so different evangelists make different choices about which women they're going to focus on. John in particular focuses on Mary Magdalene, and he doesn't even mention the other women, presumably because she's mentioned most prominently for the gospel. She was one of the key witnesses to this for years afterwards. But in particular, she was the one who went to John and Peter and said, the tomb's empty, and then they raced there to go look at it and come back. And so John had a personal interaction with her, and presumably that's why he mentions her in particular.
Oh, and because she would have related her personal experience to him. Like he would have been very familiar with that.
And had done so right there on the very first day. The two of them interacted, and that's what led John to go to the tomb.
All right. I want to just close with one question. I think it's going to be a very easy question for you.
Okay. But
do we actually believe that Christ, who the body of Christ who was crucified, physically rose from the dead?
Depends on what you mean by physical.
Okay.
Because in Greek, phusis can mean just natural. Well, his body didn't naturally rise. People don't naturally rise from the dead. But he did bodily rise. His body was no longer in the tomb. His earthly body was transmogrified to become a glorified body that had all kinds of new properties that like the ability to walk through walls, the ability to look different to people, the ability not to need food, the ability to ascend into the sky. And since we're going to be like him in the resurrection, we're going to get that same kind of bodily upgrade.
I would almost call that good news, Jimmy. They should call it that.
Sounds good to me.
They should call it the good news.
I like that.
Jimmy Akin, thank you.
Get the marketing team on that.
Yeah. We'll get them together. We'll get a meeting together. Thank you for being with us on this Good Friday.
My pleasure.
And a very blessed Easter to you.
Blessed Easter to you and to the listeners.
Amen to that. And remember, pray for all those in Egypt and keep Pope Francis in your prayers as he prepares to go to Egypt. Next hour, Father Vincent Serpa will be here with us for a meditation on the Passion of the Lord. I'm Cy Kellett. This is Catholic Answers, and we'll be right back.